Raytheon Technologies, the second largest arms manufacturer in the world, is one major provider of these weapons. It stands out from the rest of its competitors because of its close ties with Saudi Arabia, having been the first weapons manufacturer to build a permanent operation there in 1960s, hiring members of the Saudi royal family as consultants and opening a branch of the company in Riyadh in 2017. After the war began in March 2015, Raytheon's stock price went from about $108 to more than $180 in 2019, reflecting billions of dollars in weapons sales to Saudi Arabia. Despite the countless threats connecting Raytheon to Saudi Arabia and its financial interest in continuing the war in Yemen, the company portrays itself as a neutral force which simply carries out the foreign policy of U.S. government and therefore is not responsible for the destruction wrought by its weapons. When Vice President of Business Development and CEO of Raytheon Company International John D. Harris II was asked by CNBC in a February 2019 interview about the use of Raytheon bombs in Yemen, his response was, "We are an element of U.S. policy. Our role is not to make policy. Our role is to comply with it." By characterizing itself as an obedient, law-abiding company, Raytheon not only attempts to weasel out of its culpability, but also obfuscates the horrific tragedy playing out in Yemen and other countries where its bombs fall. The reality is the harrowing situation in Yemen can be directly traced back to Raytheon and other weapons manufacturers' influence on U.S. foreign policy. This is not due to a lack of government checks and balances or oversight. Rather, it is the result of a calculated policy of the U.S. government to ensure its dominant geopolitical position in the world, which includes maximizing the profit interests of these companies at the expense of Yemeni lives. Raytheon's claims of neutrality fall flat when one takes a closer look at its influence on U.S. policy, including both explicit lobbying of government officials and its unified interests with members of the U.S. political elite. The revolving door between private companies and government positions has supported Raytheon's goals. In fact, Raytheon has managed to insert itself as a permanent fixture at the highest levels of government. Obama and Trump both had former Raytheon lobbyists serve in senior roles in the Defense Department, William Lane and Mark Esper, respectively. And Biden is continuing the tradition, choosing General Lloyd Austin, who sits on the Raytheon board, for Defense Secretary and breezed through his confirmation hearing without issue on January 19. While the situation in Yemen continued to dramatically deteriorate during the Obama administration, Trump shares the blame with his predecessor. Obama played a key role in starting the war, giving Saudi Arabia a green light for its initial attack. He also worked to expand U.S. arms sales abroad, including to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. In 2013, Obama oversaw a big increase in U.S. arms sales to foreign governments that has enabled Saudi Arabia's current assault on Yemen. As a result, U.S. arms exports went from $6.9 billion in 2009 to $8.7 billion in 2012, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's database, a 25% increase. Of that, U.S. arms exports to Saudi Arabia increased by 4,489% between 2008 to 2012 and 2013 to 2017. Despite his grandiose campaign rhetoric about change and progress, Obama enabled and deepened the same corruption he had previously denounced. 3 days into his presidency, Obama waived a rule prohibiting lobbyists from working in the government on issues they had lobbied on for 2 years. He then nominated William Lynn, a ranking lobbyist and head of company's Division for Government Operations and Strategy, as his Deputy Secretary of Defense. In 2015, when the war in Yemen began, Obama agreed to back Saudi Arabia's invasion of Yemen by qualifying weapon sales as defensive support. Obama was well aware that weapons sold to Saudi Arabia would not be used for defense, but would instead be used to attack Yemen. Since then, U.S. support for the war has been indispensable to Saudi Arabia's ability to slaughter Yemenis. Saudi Arabia has very little ability to produce weapons on its own, so it is reliant on foreign companies for its military capabilities and maintenance. U.S. weapon sales are therefore essential for Saudi Arabia's siege of Yemen. In addition to weapon sales, U.S. support for the war initially included refueling Saudi bombers twice a day. As of January 2021, the U.S. still provides logistical support and intelligence.
The end of the Cold War came as a huge relief to the people of the world, who felt that the bipolar world order tension had finally ended, and the world could settle down and live in peace. However, it seems that the Western powers still needed a scapegoat to target, and hence the birth of Islamophobia was commenced, and in the process, the Western media created a new enemy. Yet in 2015, following a spate of numerous events around the world, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, wrote a letter to the youth of the Western world asking them to ignore the media and reconsider the image of Islam. But it seems that the leader's message of 6 years ago is still very much valid today, as his words are well reflected in the ongoing spreading of fear and the spreading of hatred demonstrated by Western leaders towards Islam and Muslims in general. One only has to look at the far-right ideologies of ex-US President Donald Trump, who during his tenure instigated one of the most controversial and discriminatory laws ever passed when he executed his so-called travel ban on countries with a majority Muslim population. Although it was not Trump who started Islamophobia, he certainly added fuel to the fire through his words and actions.
I'm here to protest Donald Trump's racist, xenophobic immigration order, which is against everything that America is about and against everything I stand for as a human.
Yet the leader of the Islamic Revolution raised a very valid point 6 years ago, and is one that stands true more than ever today as technology advances and has encouraged the youth of the world to break down the barriers fabricated across the globe and use the tools and resources so readily available to educate themselves about the truth, hence exposing the lies and deceit created and encouraged by the likes of Donald Trump et al. When it comes to Islam. With some people being led to believe that Islam is the world enemy, so many fail to see the consequences of Western actions, either directly or indirectly against Islam and Muslims, hence proving that back in 2015, the leader knew that the time had come for enlightenment, and as the message stands as strong as ever today, sadly, the youth of the West are still falling to the influence of negative images, catalyzed and sparked by real extremists around the world, whose sole aim is to create division and tension between mankind. When the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo published offensive pictures of the Prophet Muhammad, the Muslim world reacted with anger, stating that the line between freedom of speech and respect for religion and faith had been breached, and saw the resulting attack on the HQ of Charlie Hebdo, condemned by the world over, including Muslims, who were horrified by the extremist reaction. Yet the republication of the cartoons, as well as the rise of the far right that stemmed from the events, have seen a huge rise of Islamophobia in France, and is something that's almost been encouraged by French leaders, who have failed to condemn the actions taken under the so-called pretext of free speech. Yet it seems that time is not a healer when it comes to such acts, as the rise of Islamophobia begins to gather pace across Europe, in part assisted by the French, exporting their model of Islamophobia across the continent, according to the international head of CAGE, an NGO based in the UK that fights against the discrimination against Muslims. Although the world is currently distracted by events such as the COVID-19 pandemic and various social political events around the world, some have taken a stance against the ongoing phenomenon of Islamophobia, making sure the problem is brought to the attention of the highest authorities. It's hence why some 36 NGOs from across 13 nations around the world have sought intervention by the United Nations to tackle the problem from the top, encouraging world leaders to take a stance against Islamophobia as they would any other form of discrimination or hate. What now remains to be seen is whether a change of president in the US and the lifting of the so-called travel ban will start a new era in the world order and encourage other world leaders and the youth of the West to take a new look at Islam and finally understand that hatred being spread by a small minority should once and forever remain a thing of the past.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump took full advantage of his last hours in office this week to push through a flurry of controversial decisions. One of Trump's final acts was signing a deal to sell state-of-the-art warplanes and drones to the United Arab Emirates. His administration reportedly signed the deal just 1 hour before Trump's tumultuous presidential term was over. Under the agreement, the UAE is expected to receive 50 stealth F-35 warplanes and 18 advanced Reaper drones. The Emiratis have long expressed interest in getting the stealth jets. The UAE was promised a chance to purchase them when it agreed to normalize relations with Israel last August, angering the Palestinians. The arms deal was pushed by the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who is central to the normalization of ties with Israel. The weapons package is considered another part of Trump's notorious dealings with Persian Gulf Arab allies, which have long records of human rights violations. The Emiratis, for instance, have been deeply involved in the devastating Saudi-led war on Yemen, which has triggered the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UAE has carried out a large number of aerial bombardments in Yemen where hospitals, schools, weddings, and funerals have been among the targets on the ground. The business-minded former U.S. president boosted weapons transfers to its regional allies despite outcry by human rights advocates. A coalition of human rights organizations recently urged the U.S. to avoid further arms sales to the United Arab Emirates. The rights groups believe more arms for the Emiratis would worsen a set of bloody conflicts in Yemen, Libya, and beyond. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was dismissive of such warnings. The United States itself has been deeply involved in the Yemen war ever since it began in 2015. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies has included mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. During his presidential campaign, the new U.S. president signaled a major shift. He has pledged to take a tough line on human rights issues, even when it comes to America's allies. Biden has also hinted at ending weapons transfers and military support to the Saudi-led coalition pounding Yemen. But critics say actions speak louder than words. They say there is no guarantee that Biden will change America's approach as he promised. Saudi and Emirati petrodollars have proved irresistible to many American presidents. Is Joe Biden really willing to put human rights first and change America's stance in the region?
I don't think any American government, any American president is going to step completely away from the petrodollars coming into the American defense industry. However, I think everyone has to realize in Washington and elsewhere is that this war, I hate to keep harping on American national security, but what does it have to do with American national security?
How will he deal with powerful Saudi and Emirati lobbies in Washington? Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regimes of Saudi Arabia and UAE, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
The British military complex is a shadow of its former empirical past, plagued by huge budget deficits, deteriorating equipment, and a very demoralized group of staff. Therefore, in order to bolster the bank balance, the British have leaned on their experience in the service sector and have turned their military into a training facilitator for paying customers. Following a Freedom of Information request by an anti-arms sales group, it's become apparent that the UK military has recently been responsible for training foreign military forces from over 150 countries around the world, equating to some two-thirds of the global countries, and has included tasks from battle training to military band practice. Whereas this could be seen as a sensible way of making money, the reality is that some 15 of the countries who have paid for the training have been rebuked by the British authorities for violations of human rights abuses, raising the question as to just how serious the British are when it comes to human rights and why they would agree to train such countries.
This is a difficult situation, and the opposition parties in Parliament have raised the question. The campaigning organisation at the centre of the current story, the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, has tried through the courts to bring into force a more coherent British ethical foreign policy. But that has not happened so far, and the Ministry of Defence considers that its relationships, particularly with certain Gulf monarchies, is very strong and important for Britain, and therefore it is basically giving them a green card to go ahead with doing what they want.
Media spokesman for the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, Andrew Smith, was quoted as saying that the Act raises a very serious question for the British government, asking why they are so readily willing to support countries that apply repressive laws and have been accused of torture or have a known history of human rights violations. Yet the British government and military complex downplayed the allegations, stating that such cooperation was merely part of the statecraft designed to improve international diplomatic relations, claiming that all decisions are made on a country-by-country basis. Yet with the UK on its knees financially from the impact of Brexit and the COVID-19 pandemic, it seems that when it comes to income, one can turn a blind eye to certain events, as every little helps when it comes to earning money. When the former British Prime Minister Theresa May travelled to the Persian Gulf to meet the leaders of Bahrain, the sole intention of the visit was to represent and sell British-made weapons to the island, and is something that's emulated today with other such nations in the West Asia region. With Saudi Arabia also a loyal customer of Britain when it comes to the arms trade, it seems that money flowing in from the arms trade to Britain is enough to divert attention away from the repressive regimes that they sell to. In fact, the Saudi-led war on Yemen is a prime example of such oppression, with Saudi bombs killing over 100,000 people in the country, making up nearly half of the 233,000 people who have lost their lives as a direct or indirect result of the war on Yemen. With the supply of arms knowingly being sold to the Saudis to perform such actions, are then the British not an accomplice to the crimes being committed by Riyadh? And if so, should the UK not be sanctioned for their role in the deaths of so many innocent civilians?
Well, certainly there's been concern expressed about British training for sniper forces in Bahrain, given the efforts of Bahrain Defence Force against the Shia majority population in certain situations, and then of course British support through the arms trade for the Saudi led coalition's efforts in the war in Yemen since 2015. So this is something which is certainly full of contradictions, and again the opposition parties in Parliament have raised these questions, would like to see the policies changed, but at the moment there is no chance of that happening so long as Boris Johnson and his Conservative ministers are in power.
Yet the truth of the matter is that Britain itself is guilty of human rights abuses and has been demonstrated throughout time, with atrocious allegations being made against British soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course a lot closer to home in the treatment of the people of the north of Ireland during the Troubles, which saw British soldiers committing acts that will long remain in the memories of the victims, hence proving that Britain has no moral values when it comes to certain issues.
The coronavirus pandemic, which resulted in prolonged lockdowns and tough preventive measures, has had an adverse effect on the global economy. Like any other crisis, countries responded differently to the COVID-19 outbreak, which determined the extent of their success in tackling the ill effects of the disease. Take China, for example, the world's second largest economy. It was bound to overtake the United States as the biggest economy in 2030. But according to economists, the Asian country is expected to pass the U.S. 2 years earlier, as its gross domestic product is forecast to expand by more than 8% this year alone.
I would think that the Chinese economy would overtake the U.S. economy before then, very shortly, because the Chinese government, under the leadership of President Xi Jinping, they're proceeding with a completely different economic political orientation. They see development of infrastructure and industry as primary. And of course, they've uplifted, removed from poverty almost 800 million people, which is close to three times the size of the United States.
Moreover, China is the only major economy to have avoided contraction in 2020. This was despite an ongoing economic war between Washington and Beijing. U.S. President Donald Trump levied massive tariffs on Chinese imports to offset Beijing's trade surplus with Washington. But experts argue that the U.S. lackluster handling of the coronavirus ironically gave China the economic advantage. That begs the question, what would be the upcoming U.S. administration's response to this reality? And how is Washington going to adjust its policy towards its biggest competitor? Over the past 4 years, Donald Trump's America First policy took U.S. protectionism to a new level. Trump started trade wars with allies and foes alike, ripped up trade deals, and made attempts to play against international trade rules. In hindsight, those attempts, which were predominantly made to hinder China's economic growth, have proven counterproductive. China's success to rein in the COVID-19 pandemic helped Beijing solidify its position in the global economy. Now, many American and European firms are more likely to focus on China, considering its potential to be the only large source of growth after the pandemic ends.
And under President Trump, he had a misguided conception. In fact, it's not clear he had a clear conception of what is unique about American economic policy, such as I identified the founding of our economic principles from Alexander Hamilton through Franklin Roosevelt and even into John F. Kennedy, understood the role of infrastructure in building up our economy and the role of the state. President Trump wanted to reduce the role of the state and believed that economic wealth was measured by the stock market.
President-elect Joe Biden has vowed to put an end to U.S. isolationism.
America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it. Once again, sit at the head of the table.
But achieving the leading role for the U.S. would be much harder now, considering 4 years of Trump's attempts to retreat from international norms. Also, the success of Biden's China policy, which involves creating an alliance to counter Beijing's growing clout across the world, is questionable.
It's not clear to me what President Biden's policies will be. He has surrounded himself with people from the Obama administration, primarily some from the Clinton administration. They have a pronounced anti-China bent to them. The Democrat Party is also very anti-China, as is the leadership of the Republican Party.
Trump entered the Oval Office with the promise of making America great again. What transpired in the past 4 years, however, left the country in a far different position than what the outgoing U.S. president had pledged.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Justice Department's top leaders listened in stunned silence this month. One of their peers, they were told, had devised a plan with former President Donald J. Trump to oust Jeffrey A. Rosen as acting Attorney General and wield the department's power to force Georgia state lawmakers to overturn its presidential election results. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Katie Benner and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Trump and Justice Department lawyers said to have plotted to oust acting Attorney General. Justice Department's top leaders listened in stunned silence this month. One of their peers, they were told, had devised a plan with President Donald J. Trump to oust Jeffrey A. Rosen as acting Attorney General and wield the department's power to force Georgia state lawmakers to overturn its presidential election results. The unassuming lawyer who worked on the plan, Jeffrey Clark, had been devising ways to cast doubt on the election results and to bolster Donald Trump's continuing legal battles and the pressure on Georgia politicians. Because Mr. Rosen had refused the president's entreaties to carry out those plans, Donald Trump was about to decide whether to fire Mr. Rosen and replace him with Mr. Clark. The department officials convened on a conference call, then asked each other, "What will you do if Mr. Rosen is dismissed?" The answer was unanimous. They would all resign. Their informal pact ultimately helped persuade Donald Trump to keep Mr. Rosen in place, calculating that a furore over mass resignations at the top of the Justice Department would eclipse any attention on his baseless accusations of voter fraud. Donald Trump's decision came only after Mr. Rosen and Mr. Clark made their competing cases to him in a bizarre White House meeting that two officials compared with an episode of Donald Trump's reality show, The Apprentice, albeit one that could prompt a constitutional crisis. The previously unknown chapter was the culmination of the president's long-running effort to batter the Justice Department into advancing his personal agenda. He also pressed Mr. Rosen to appoint special counsels, including one who would look into Dominion voting systems, a maker of election equipment that Donald Trump's allies had falsely said was working with Venezuela to flip votes from Mr. Trump to Joseph R. Biden Jr. This account of the department's final days under Donald Trump's leadership is based on interviews with four former Trump administration officials, who all asked not to be named because of fear of retaliation. Jeffrey Clark said that this account contained inaccuracies, but did not specify, adding that he could not discuss any conversations with Donald Trump or Justice Department lawyers because of the strictures of legal privilege. Senior Justice Department lawyers, not uncommonly, provide legal advice to the White House as part of our duties, he said. All my official communications were consistent with law. Mr. Clark categorically denied that he devised any plan to oust Mr. Rosen or to formulate recommendations for action based on factual inaccuracies gleaned from the internet. My practice is to rely on sworn testimonies to assess disputed factual claims, Mr. Clark said. There was a candid discussion of options and pros and cons with the president. It is unfortunate that those who were part of a privileged legal conversation would comment on public about such internal deliberations, while also distorting any discussions. Mr. Clark also noted that he was the lead signatory on a Justice Department request last month, asking a federal judge to reject a lawsuit that sought to pressure Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the results of the election. Donald Trump declined to comment. An advisor said that Mr. Trump has consistently argued that the Justice Department should investigate rampant election fraud that has plagued our system for years. The advisor added that any assertion to the contrary is false and being driven by those who wish to keep the system broken. Mr. Clark agreed and said that legal privileges prevented him from divulging specifics regarding the conversation. A Justice Department spokesman declined to comment, as did Mr. Rosen. When Donald Trump said on 14th of December that Attorney General William Barr was leaving the department, some official thought that he might allow Mr. Rosen a short reprieve before pressing him about voter fraud. After all, William Barr would be around for another week. Instead, Donald Trump summoned Mr. Rosen to the Oval Office just the next day. He wanted the Justice Department to file legal briefs supporting his allies' lawsuits seeking to overturn his election loss. And he urged Mr. Rosen to appoint special counsels to investigate not only unfounded accusations of widespread voter fraud, but also Dominion, the voting machines firm. Dominion has sued the pro-Trump lawyer, Sidney Powell, who inserted those accusations into four federal lawsuits about voter irregularities that were all dismissed by courts of law. Mr. Rosen refused. He maintained that he would make decisions based on the facts and the law, and he reiterated what William Barr had privately told Donald Trump. The Department of Justice had investigated voting irregularities and found no evidence whatsoever of widespread fraud. But Mr. Trump continued to press Mr. Rosen after the meeting, in phone calls and in person. He repeatedly said that he did not understand why the Justice Department had not found evidence that supported conspiracy theories about the election and some of his personal lawyers had espoused. He declared that the Department of Justice was not fighting hard enough for him. As Mr. Rosen and the Deputy Attorney General, Richard P. Donohue, pushed back, they were unaware that Mr. Clark had been introduced to Donald Trump by a Pennsylvania politician and had told the president that he agreed that fraud had affected the election results. Donald Trump quickly embraced Jeffrey Clark, who had been appointed the acting head of the Civil Division in September and was also the head of the department's Environmental and Natural Resources Division. As December wore on, Mr. Clark mentioned to Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue that he spent a lot of time reading on the internet, a comment that alarmed them because they inferred that he believed the unfounded conspiracy theory that Donald Trump had won the election. Jeffrey Clark also told them that he wanted the department to hold a news conference announcing that it was investigating serious accusations of election fraud. Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue rejected the proposal. As Donald Trump focused increasingly on Georgia, a state he lost narrowly to Joe Biden, he complained to Justice Department leaders and the U.S. Attorney in Atlanta, Byung J. Pak, was not trying to find evidence for false election claims pushed by Mr. Trump's lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, and others. Mr. Donohue warned Mr. Pak that the president was now fixated on his office, and that it might not be tenable for him to continue to lead it, according to two people familiar with the conversation. That conversation and Donald Trump's effort to pressure Georgia's Republican Secretary of State to find him votes eventually compared Byung-Jae Park to abruptly resign this month. Mr. Clark was also focused on Georgia. He drafted a letter that he wanted Mr. Rosen to send to Georgia state legislatures that wrongly said that the Justice Department was investigating accusations of voter fraud in their state and that they should move to avoid Mr. Biden's win there. Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue again rejected Mr. Clark's proposal. On New Year's Eve, the trio met to discuss Mr. Clark's refusal to hew to the department's conclusion that the election results were valid. Mr. Donohue flatly told Mr. Clark that what he was doing was wrong. The next day, Mr. Clark told Mr. Rosen, who had mentored him whilst they worked together at the law firm Kirkland & Ellis, that he was going to discuss this strategy with the president early the next week, just before Congress was set to certify Joe Biden's electoral victory. Unbeknown to the acting Attorney General, Mr. Clark's timeline moved up. He met with Donald Trump over the weekend, then informed Mr. Rosen midday on Sunday that the president intended to replace him with Mr. Clark, who could then try to stop Congress from certifying the Electoral College results. He said that Mr. Rosen could stay on as his Deputy Attorney General, leaving Mr. Rosen speechless. Unwilling to step down without a fight, Mr. Rosen said that he needed to hear straight from the president himself, Donald Trump, and work with the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, to convene a meeting for early that evening. Even as Mr. Clark's pronouncement was sinking in, stunning news broke out of Georgia. State officials had recorded an hour-long conversation published by the Washington Post, during which Donald Trump pressured them to manufacture enough votes to declare him the victor. As the fallout from the recording ricocheted through Washington, the president's desperate bid to change the outcome in Georgia came into sharp focus. Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue pressed ahead, informing Stephen Engel, the head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, about Mr. Clark's latest maneuver. Mr. Donohue convened a late afternoon call with the department's remaining senior leaders, laying out Mr. Clark's effort to replace the Attorney General, Mr. Rosen. The Attorney General, Mr. Rosen, planned to soon head to the White House to discuss his fate, Mr. Donohue told the group. Should Mr. Rosen be fired, they all agreed to resign en masse. For some, the plan brought to mind the so-called Saturday Night Massacre of the Richard Nixon era, where Attorney General at the time, Elliot Richardson, and his deputy resigned rather than carry out the president's order to fire the special prosecutor investigating him. The Clark plan, the officials concluded, would seriously harm the department, the government, and the rule of law. For hours, they anxiously messaged and called one another as they awaited Mr. Rosen's fate. Around 6 p.m., Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donohue and Mr. Clark met at the White House with Donald Trump, Pat Cipollone and his deputy, Patrick Philbin, and other lawyers. Donald Trump had Mr. Rosen and Mr. Clark present their arguments to him. Pat Cipollone advised the president not to fire Mr. Rosen, and he reiterated, as he had for days, that he did not recommend sending the letter to Georgia lawmakers. Mr. Engel advised Donald Trump that he and the department's remaining top officials would all resign if he fired Mr. Rosen, leaving Mr. Clark alone at the Department of Justice. Donald Trump seemed somewhat swayed by the idea that firing Mr. Rosen would trigger not only chaos at the Justice Department, but also congressional investigations and possibly recriminations from other Republicans, and distract attention from his efforts to overturn the election results. After nearly 3 hours at the meeting at the White House, Donald Trump ultimately decided that Mr. Clark's plan would fail, and he allowed Mr. Rosen to stay on as Attorney General.
Donald Trump has become the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice following the riots at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. He has also been banned by Twitter and deplatformed by almost every social media site. Democrats and incoming President Joe Biden celebrated the move and are calling for new anti-terror laws to be implemented with a lot of similar rhetoric we've heard before. Some speculate that we're entering a new domestic war on terror. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. After months of Donald Trump saying the election was stolen from him in favor of Joe Biden and disputing the results endlessly on social media, his supporters held a Stop the Steal rally in Washington, D.C. as the Electoral College was taking place to formally declare Biden the winner. We saw videos of people fighting with police, smashing in windows, and struggling to overcome security in order to get inside the Capitol building and disrupt the process. Weirdly enough, for what is supposedly one of the most secure buildings on Earth, there was no police response anywhere near as violent or repressive as we saw last summer against the Black Lives Matter protesters following the death of George Floyd. Interestingly enough, we saw other videos of people at the Capitol just being let inside as barriers were lifted and doors were opened, ushering in scores of disgruntled MAGA hat-wearing protesters, some bearing arms and Confederate flags. Following these events, Donald Trump simply told people to just go home and that he loved them, and continued to post on Twitter that the election was stolen from him, and this ultimately led to him being permanently banned by the platform that he infamously used as his main podium and soapbox during these last years. What's interesting to note here is the double standard that Twitter seems to employ in regards to how it handled the situation. At first, during the last couple of months, social media sites decided to place warnings under Donald Trump's tweets and posts because he was disputing the results of the election, alleging it had been stolen from him. Many of his supporters across the country began echoing these same claims and holding protests in response. In the lead-up to the Capitol riots, Trump announced there would be a big protest in D.C., calling on his supporters to be there and be wild. After the riots took place, Twitter banned Trump's account, but not for that particular tweet, for different ones, which Twitter outlined in their reasoning. They cited two tweets by Trump, one saying that people who voted for him had been treated disrespectfully and unfairly, all 75 million of them, and another tweet announcing that he would not be attending the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. Twitter said that these tweets violated their glorification of violence policy. Now, that's a very interesting thing because Donald Trump has been president now for almost 4 years, and on Twitter much longer than that. He came on Twitter and confessed to the murder of General Qasem Soleimani, and he was very proud of it too. He also threatened to bomb Iran on several occasions, making direct threats to the president and even threatening to bomb Iran's cultural sites. He also threatened other nations like Russia, Syria, and Turkey directly on the same platform. These are barbaric, primitive acts. This is not just glorifying violence, it's threatening violence, which also goes against Twitter's rules and the rules of many other sites and platforms, and it's not something that is considered free speech usually to threaten violence in most supposed liberal democracies. Yet, nonetheless, Trump was allowed to do so for years. No one stopped him. Where were these same arbiters? Where was the same outrage at Trump's behavior when he was glorifying bombing and sanctioning other countries? Why do they only care once it happens at home, but never abroad? There is also the concern and broader implications of what it means for a sitting U.S. president to be deplatformed by all these big tech companies in Silicon Valley and for them to decide what constitutes permissible speech. This isn't just to do with Trump, but also to do with freedom of expression, the ability of journalists to do their jobs, for us to know what heads of state are saying, and also whether these websites are platforms or publishers, because it seems they want to have their cake and eat it too. Now, yes, while some think it's perhaps a great thing that we don't have to hear from Trump anymore and we can all celebrate that he's gone, it's also very worrying to think what these same tech companies might do in the future to others who disagree with them and have done in the past. We've seen Twitter, Facebook, and Google do this to leftist, anti-imperialist, and other adversarial voices on several occasions. Press TV just recently had its Google and YouTube accounts shut down. We've seen the Venezuelan-based Telesur also purged from Facebook in the past, not to mention many other independent or dissenting voices who oppose the wars and the American political establishment. So if you think this is only going to happen to people on the right or only to fascists, think again, because you're sorely mistaken. Another argument being made astonishingly by people on the supposed left is that, well, Twitter and others are private companies, so it's well within their rights to get rid of Trump. First of all, I never thought I'd hear people on the left arguing in favor of corporations doing whatever they like, irrespective of the broader implications that this might have on public discourse. After all, whether we like it or not, in the 21st century, the main arena of public discourse is predominantly the internet and takes place online. So to merely chalk this up as a corporation making a business decision is disingenuous. However, to those who think that these big tech companies are just private entities operating in Silicon Valley, I'd like to offer them a stark reminder. Back in 2009, when there were protests in Iran disputing the results of the presidential election, Twitter was being used to coordinate them. The US State Department realized this and even reached out to Twitter, asking them not to undergo scheduled maintenance of their website, just for the sake of keeping those protests in Iran going. If Twitter is acting at the behest of foreign policy decision makers in Washington, D.C., then it's no longer just a private company. Also, note the irony that when people in the United States dispute election results, they put labels on their tweets and deplatform them. But when you do it in Iran, Twitter has no problem and will even take a break from fixing its own website just for the sake of keeping the civil unrest going. The same goes for the so-called Arab Spring, where social media sites like Facebook and Twitter carried the movement. These platforms were the primary vehicle through which protests, dissent, and information were organized and disseminated in order to bring about revolution. Twitter and others never stepped in to stop any of this. They encouraged it. And this shows that there is a clear double standard and glaring hypocrisy on their part. Not to mention that in 2013, through the revelations of whistleblower Edward Snowden, we now know that the National Security Agency, the NSA, was working with big tech companies like Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, and many more in order to collect information on everyone in bulk and spy on their communications and activities online in what was called the PRISM program. So once again, to say that these companies are private, when they have demonstrated many times in the past that they not only cooperate, but carry out the agenda of the US government and its national security state, is delusional. Clearly, they're okay with revolt, insurrection, and civil unrest when it happens in Arab countries or in Iran or abroad, and will even help foment those movements. However, once it happens at home and doesn't suit their friends in the national security blob or the Democratic Party, then they will step in to put an end to it. Notice once again the hypocrisy of how a majority of the politicians in Washington, including Trump, had no problem supporting the fascist coup in Bolivia led by white supremacist groups who overthrew Evo Morales, destroying his home, trashing his sister's home and those of other government officials. People were killed there too. The US government had no problem supporting a coup in Venezuela either, with Silver Corps or picking the puppet Juan Guaido and ridiculously dubbing him interim president. The United States had no problem sponsoring and supporting Daesh inside of Syria in order to overthrow the government. They had no problem supporting the Contras in Nicaragua or secret CIA projects like the Phoenix program in Vietnam. The United States has supported countless coups in other countries, helping to overthrow governments and leaders of other nations. The United States and its empire are the vehicle through which white supremacy is disseminated globally. They march their armies into other lands, subjugating people of color, killing them, and stealing their resources. And ironically, all these wars and conflicts are exported from that very same building, the Capitol. So if US politicians are really horrified at what took place, maybe they shouldn't do it to others. Now, beyond the hypocrisy of the regime in DC, it's important to note the fallout of the riots that transpired at the Capitol and what policy measures are being taken next. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer gave a speech comparing the riots to Pearl Harbor. The incoming president, Joe Biden, said that his top priority will be to pass a domestic terror law. In the media itself, we saw the New York Times begin to float the idea of the Sedition Act, an archaic law from the First World War and prior, which was used to euthanize the First Amendment and jail anyone who criticizes the government during wartime. We also saw a recent report about how the FBI knew there would be violence taking place at the Capitol, but didn't do anything about it out of fear they would violate the First Amendment. Now, this is, of course, a story that is written to condition people into thinking that in order for you to be kept safe, you have to give up your rights. It's the exact same logic that was used in the wake of 9/11, the same fear-mongering and scare tactics in order to acquiesce people into believing and accepting that they would be more safe if they gave up some of their civil liberties. This is exactly how things like the war on terror were sold to the general public, how the imperialist wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were accepted as some kind of necessity, and also how the mass surveillance programs were born and led to things like the Patriot Act, and why some are worried that a new Patriot Act might be on the way. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me to talk more is journalist Whitney Webb, writer and researcher for Unlimited Hangout. Thanks for coming on the show, Whitney. Good to have you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
We've seen a lot of Democrats using what I simply call neocon or neoconservative language after what happened at the Capitol, saying things like, our democracy is under attack, you're either with us or against us. Very similar to George Bush and his cronies. And so there's a lot of sentiment now going around that what happened at the Capitol is going to be used to usher in a new age of the war on terror and pass all these authoritarian laws in order to trample on civil liberties and freedom of speech. How do you see this playing out right now in the immediate future with Biden taking over and also in the long term?
Okay, well, in the short term, I think we're already seeing, right, the reintroduction of legislation that has been introduced really over the past 2 years about domestic terror, but they're mainly focused on preventing domestic terror events before they happen, which is basically a pivot and a push towards pre-crime, which obviously is going to be very surveillance heavy. As far as January 6th goes, I have been calling that really the opening act for this war on domestic terror, because the type of systems they want to implement, they haven't manufactured enough consent for that, and so they require more events, maybe in the same style as January 6th, or maybe something even more intense and severe that causes a greater loss of life and things like that going forward in order to introduce this stuff. And as far as the Democrats parroting neocon talking points, really after the 2016 election, we saw neocons being brought into the resistance fold, people like Bill Kristol, for example, but also sort of this joining of the DNC with, Romney-style Republicans who were basically neocons coming together to form what I really call the Uniparty. And now after January 6th, you know, the mask of that has really come off, and we're seeing that wing of the Republicans joining with the Democrats, and they will be putting through a lot of this nightmare legislation, particularly as you have the Biden administration with a majority of their party in both houses of Congress. So in the short term, it's definitely disconcerting. In the long term, that's really up to the people if they're really going to go along with this. And it's very interesting that we're seeing this being sold more to anyone else than to progressives, really. And that's why I think we're having like the Squad playing such a central role in trying to sell this to their base in particular. But really what this is divide and conquer on a massive scale, and how this plays out in the long term depends on how long that continues to be successful for.
So I'll ask an obvious question here, but why is this particularly dangerous for the left? Because as you mentioned, we see people in the Squad, we see many people in the Democratic Party cheering this on. So, I mean, how is this going to hurt the left, not just online in terms of censorship and deplatforming, but also in terms of direct action, you know, being able to exercise your civil liberties, your right to protest, your right to organize.
Well, every time the state gets these expanded powers, you just have to look historically who the U.S. national security state targets, whether it's domestically or abroad, and the answer across the board is the left. If you look initially at where a lot of what the groundwork for this war on domestic terror, where it was set up, it was done by the CIA in Vietnam, targeting supposed leftists or leftist sympathizers, and then that was taken by the CIA, used to set up Operation Condor in Latin America, where there were a lot of CIA military-backed dictatorships, where they similarly went up after the left. And the same is true also for efforts to infiltrate and destroy through programs like COINTELPRO, social and political movements in the U.S. in the 1960s and what have you. So, I mean, the fact that we're having progressives cheer this on shows, you know, in a sense, either an ignorance or a decision to choose to forget about that history and how it tends to affect those types of social movements. And what's interesting is a lot of these domestic terror bills, while they talk about far-right extremism and things like that, the ACLU has pointed out that those laws would be used or most likely to be used to target minorities, environmental activists, and generally speaking, activist causes that are generally associated with the progressive left.
We've heard people say that the U.S. does not need more laws against terrorism. It already has enough. They say they're just not being enforced properly. So what is your take on that? Do you think the laws designed to prevent terrorism are already plentiful, or do you think they're just not being enforced enough? What's going on here?
Yeah, well, I think there's plenty of laws already on the books, and I think that is definitely true. What they're trying to do here is they're trying to be able to add federal terror offenses to things, to certain things, including things that aren't necessarily considered crimes in the United States. So now after January 6th, we're being told that basically occupying a federally owned building is going to be treated, we can presume from the language being used in the legislation being put out there, an act of domestic terrorism. If you think about it, that would essentially criminalize the practice of sit-in style protests, which of course have been fundamental to activist movements throughout history, the civil rights movement being an obvious example that a lot of people know about. Sit-ins were very instrumental in affecting change in that case. So to criminalize that type of activity is very dangerous, and people really need to stop coming at this from such an emotionally charged space and think about the consequences of this, because the establishment clearly doesn't want us sitting down and thinking about how the logical consequences of where these things will go. They want us to impulsively get behind these pushes for expansion of the national security state without really thinking about it.
So they're calling what happened at the Capitol a coup. A lot of the lawmakers, the media, they're saying it was a full-blown attempt to overthrow the U.S. government. How do you see that in regards to many of the things you just mentioned, where the U.S. Overthrows other governments, assassinates leaders, launches full-blown CIA programs to subvert the governments of other countries? I mean, do you think they're throwing that term around lightly, or perhaps trying to exaggerate what happened and play on people's emotions?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think they're playing on the fact that most Americans are completely ignorant of the actual coup attempts that have happened in history that have largely been done by the U.S. government or U.S. intelligence in countries abroad, and the consequences of those coup attempts and how they actually play out. I mean, the death toll from January 6th is extremely low for, you know, something like a CIA-backed coup attempt in places like Chile in 1973 or something like that. So I really don't agree with that language. And I think the only way that characterization is sticking is because a lot of people just don't know the history or the fact that, you know, we do the U.S. government has done coup attempts abroad for decades and decades and decades.
Right. They're deplatforming Trump from every social media site, even TikTok.
Or Pinterest.
I'm wondering, going forward, how is this going to affect the left? Because while people are cheering on for Nazis and white supremacists and Trump to be banned, okay, great. But we've seen how in the past, how leftists, foreigners, anti-imperialist outlets have also been banned, like Press TV or Telesur. So, I mean, shouldn't leftists be concerned about what's happening? Should